You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 476 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Caracino,
and we are coming to you from the same location.
Hello.
This week in Kennewick, Washington. Not quite the home of the fabulous Cousin Katie, but close enough. We're in the Tri-Cities.
We are in Benton County.
Oh, did I get backwards?
Nobody knows that happened, but yes.
Oh, no. All right, we'll save that.
How do you get it backwards? You just got it wrong.
Well, there's two counties on the different sides of the river. So.
Yeah, but you didn't confuse two of them. You just got a thing wrong. That's not getting it backwards.
But I got backwards which side was which.
ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton doesn't get things wrong. He gets things backwards.
I mean, that's still a subcategory of being wrong. It's just if I had said that we were in Adams County, that would have been wrong.
Oh, I've never once heard of Adams County, but...
I'm pretty sure that's around here somewhere.
No shots to it.
Oh, no.
Anyway, we are home of, for a brief period of time, Russell Wilson.
Yeah. Yeah, he was on the... Now he was on the Franklin County side? Because we're on the Benton County side?
I don't know. I've got it backwards.
Because the Tri-City Dust Devils played across the river in Pasco, but...
And hated rivals, the Tri-City Americans.
This is... Who do play on this side of the river. They do play in Kennewick at the Toyota Center. This is the... Our annual family vacation and in-person podcasts that you will sometimes refer to as a flu game.
I'm
because
fresh.
You've been sitting in the sun.
Pretty fresh. Shouts to the clouds today.
The clouds were in full force today. Well, let's get into it. We're not primarily going to describe our trip to Eastern Washington today. We are going to do the usual fare, starting with the toasts. And a congratulations to Julio Rodriguez, the first player in MLB history to start his career with four consecutive 2020 seasons. Never been done, excluding nobody.
Incredible that he was able to do that while sucking.
Well, every Mariners fan thinking that he was terrible and disappointment.
I mean, I'm also guilty of this, so I can't exactly complain. You know, it's like Julio has achieved so much while also being kind of bad sometimes.
Yes, yes. Look, Julio, like all of us, contains multitudes, but those multitudes are pretty good after the All-Star break.
Here's what I will say about Julio. This is partially about containing multitudes. We are incredibly early on in Julio Rodriguez's career.
Absolutely.
He is extraordinarily young. So, I mean, had Cal Raleigh even made his major league debut when he was Julio's age?
I believe we looked this up not long ago and the answer was no.
The amount that we've expected from Julio Rodriguez is probably too much.
Or maybe that he had made his major league debut, but was pre-going back to the minors. He had not stuck in the majors for good by Julio's current age. So...
No, I mean, it's been an impressive feat for Julio. But
it's tough because Cal Raleigh is so old now. He has gone over the hill since the All-Star break.
It's funny, though, because the expectations that we've had for Julio, in so many different ways, Julio has obliterated the actual expectations for a player like Julio Rodriguez. And there are so many players who have been one of the top prospects in baseball. And
there might have been a couple of hyped outfield prospects previous to Julio Rodriguez in Mariners history.
Yeah, I mean, even being at the level, if this is Julio's career, if this is who he is, if he's a 2020 player for the rest of his career, that would still be a phenomenal outcome. And especially with the defense and center field, that would be a phenomenal outcome for Julio Rodriguez as a career. We're only 4 years in right now.
Julio is a week away, based on his current age, of Cal Raleigh's age when he made his MLB debut in 2021.
So he's still currently younger.
Yes. So got another week.
All four of these 2020 seasons have happened before Cal Raleigh even debuted.
He has, what is it now? He's now at precisely 100 career home runs.
And that's a number of star baseball players as well. So
yeah, obviously that's not unique to Cal Raleigh.
What Julio has achieved is extraordinarily impressive. And what he can achieve is still impressive, but I think we shouldn't take for granted who he is as a player right now, but also know that there's still room for growth, and I think that's exciting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Congrats to UW product Andrew Kittredge, who threw an immaculate seventh inning for the Cubs Wednesday against Cincinnati. I didn't hear any of the Mariners broadcast on Wednesday night, but I gotta assume that Aaron Goldsmith was just constantly referencing the Immaculate Inning.
That's pretty cool. As also, Aaron Goldsmith is a person who's from the Midwest. He's just constantly talking about Midwestern baseball.
Well, this ties both the Midwest and the Pacific Northwest, certainly. Congrats to Gabby Williams, who set the Storm's single-season franchise record with her 75th steal on Tuesday, just the team's 30th game, and she's already surpassed what players did in 40 games the past two seasons. Now the WNBA playing a record 44-game schedule, and Gabby Williams is going to blow this mark out of the water, set the bar very high, hopefully for her in future seasons. And now it's time to get into it.
Oh.
Congrats to Andrew Tate. Still not that one. Oh,
God.
What is
that? Don't isolate that. Nobody aggregate the Pelton cast.
What is third C. Farapalo Mechanical Cup Trophy on Sunday, driving the U91 after being stuck is a trailer at the
I
Gold
forgot
Cup.
We were even talking about Seafair.
Yeah, it seems so long ago to you. After being stuck as a trailer boat.
He said that to you. Like, it doesn't to you. It seems so long ago to you, as if we discussed that.
No, I don't know.
You just knew it seemed like a long time ago to me?
It seems fresh to me.
You could feel it.
After being stuck as a trailer boat at the Gold Cup here in the Tri-Cities and losing the High Points lead to Corey Peabody in the U9 Beacon Plumbing, Tate enjoyed a perfect weekend on Lake Washington, leading in qualifying, winning all three heats.
Hydroplane Immaculate Inning.
Yes. Jeff Bernard won two heats in the U12 Graham Trucking Saturday, while J. Michael Kelly in the U8, the Beacon Electric, got the other heat win on Sunday. Then in a wild final, Tate secured lane three with Jamie Nielsen in the UL11 Flavor Pack, and Bernard is slower boats inside of him. Tate led pretty much wire to wire, and any threat was neutralized when Nielsen, along with J. Michael Kelly, were penalized for jumping the gun at the start. Bernard was also subsequently disqualified for violating the safety zone prior to the start, driving through a part of the course that is not allowed. That gave Peabody second place, despite losing power prior to the start and having to start from the outside. That capped a weekend where Peabody saw his boat go through a rooster tail in the first heat and not finish on Saturday, then had to leave the pits later in the day due to a family emergency. That meant J. Michael Kelly jumped into his teammate's boat and raced in both heat 2A with the Beacon Plumbing and heat 2B with his usual Beacon Electric in the two Beacon boats. Peabody, thankfully, everything was okay. He was able to return on Sunday. But Andrew Tate reclaimed the High Points lead heading into the season finale next month in San Diego. The U91 leads the U8 by 424 points, the U9 by 436 points. So things would have to go pretty wrong now for the U91 to avoid repeating as High Points champion.
An impressive performance. You were out there on Lake Washington on Saturday, is that right?
I saw one of these three heats. I was able to, or one of these three sets of heats. I was able to see 2A and 2B as well as the Blue Angels on Saturday afternoon. Sunday was at Climate Pledge Arena for Storm Fever. So that cost me the opportunity to see the Seafair final this year.
Did you have any takeaways, perspectives?
Seafair, I keep getting older. It stays the same age. I mean, that's not really true, but you know, it's everything.
You go to a whole different side of the park now.
You experienced this side, the north side of the park, for the first time this year. What did you think?
I thought it was great.
Yeah, that's what I think.
It's very
too.
Chill over there.
Got some, got a sandwich from Mio Posto.
Oh, did you?
After I parked and was about to walk in. Yeah, it was
looked
a
pretty
grand
good.
Old time.
I kind of wanted to go there. I like that side of the park. It was pretty calm. I feel like you're probably wrong about you keep getting older and it stays the same age, because I do think Seafair has transformed quite a bit.
Yes, the fact that they finish now with the Blue Angels to make it clear what the real
start. So they're the last thing.
The final heat was, you know, running around 3:15.
I noticed that they fly kind of late.
And then the Blue Angels were, you know, 3:45 to 4 at some point in that window. I got stuck with the low show. A huge disappointment. You miss out on all their best stuff.
On Saturday?
Yeah.
Was the low show?
Even though it was
sunny
by that point.
I think Sunday must have also.
Oh, Sunday was for sure the low show.
Sunday was, it was not a great Blue Angels weekend. Friday was the best day. I think I probably got the best experience of the Blue Angels being at Seahawks practice.
Yeah, that was on Thursday, right?
Yeah.
Classic American summer move.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. It was nice to, it's fun seeing hydroplanes live. And I think caring about it as a competitive sport is a difficult thing to do, because they make it an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. Like, your description of these races are like, that's not, you're like, this boat led wire to wire, won every single race. And then also many of like the second and third place boats were disqualified for various reasons and things. It's just, they're making it real hard on us.
I they are. I don't think there's a solution to it.
No, I don't know if there is either. Also, I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily know what's going on while viewing.
They have done a better job. We talked about the broadcast, the streaming broadcast, because I think you saw it when I was streaming it on my phone on Saturday, and they have really stepped it up this year. So credit to H1 Unlimited
but
in that
regard. You're at the races, do you know what's going on?
I was able to stream it was the nice thing. If you're at the races
and you're not an elderly person with a radio or streaming, do you know what's going on?
Well, they have microphones in the south turn, certainly, and closer in the north turn than I was.
So that people can hear the broadcast.
Yeah. So you would, and they do a good job of explaining this is what we're seeing on the water, but you never know about some of the penalties.
Did you go into the field? Did it get busier?
No.
Okay.
No, I studiously avoid that area.
Oh, wow. Okay. Studiously.
Yes.
There was a Boeing setup about robotics, and then there was a lot of military industrial complex in the back.
I stayed the same age.
And then there was some food, and that was pretty much it.
Although I do miss the Pepsi challenge from 1993.
It's like,
I got so good at telling the Pepsi challenge from the level of bubbles in the two.
It's funny that that's the case now, but was it between Pepsi and Coke?
Yeah.
Because now I feel like I would destroy Pepsi versus Coke.
I read something about this recently. So the way that it works is they give you the Pepsi first, and because Pepsi has more sugar, it kind of blows out your taste buds, and Coke doesn't taste as good if they give it to you second. That's the way it works.
Pepsi has more sugar than Coke?
I think that's the case. I may be flipping it, but I read something about that recently.
Interesting. About the Pepsi challenge from 1991. You were then an oral history of it?
I have no idea. I could not.
The rigorous oral history of the Pepsi challenge.
It was all about Seafair 1993. There was an extended section about Mark and Mitch Evans. Let's remember some guys. And Dave Vilwalk somehow still driving.
Yeah.
Still winning races.
He's at least a crew chief.
Well, he won his first race in 1992. I believe 93 would have been the season that he was. Maybe 94 was the season where he was driving and repeatedly flipped the boat and got fired, including here in the Tri-Cities.
There we go.
Just as we were walking in, a core memory for sure.
Just as we were walking in late?
Yeah.
I sort of remember. I mean, I was 8. I would say I remember that very well, but it
could have been 94. I can't tell for sure if that was 93 or 94.
It's one of those things. I don't necessarily need to participate in it, but I'm happy that it's happening.
Well, you know what's happening.
What is that?
What is not abandoned?
Hello.
It's our search for Seattle's best cookie.
No. Are we doing this? We're confident enough that we're on the same page here?
If we're not, then
we'll rouse Katie.
Katie can't help us. So the famous cousin Katie was supposed to come on as third Pelton brother to
you
help us
voted
judge
her MVP. Just remember that.
Our first quarterfinal here. We talked about recently on the podcast, we have segmented these into our cookie only locations. We need to create a term for that. You know, I don't. You can muse on what that might be versus the general bakery category. So we're starting off in the cookie only category with Bell's in Hello Robin, because those are the two locations that were open on Monday that I could buy a large quantity of cookies for and bring them over here to Kennewick so that we could all eat them. But not all of us did eat them. The famous cousin Katie did not have either of the cookies.
I explicitly instructed her to eat both.
I was there. I witnessed it.
I can
confirm.
There's a witness to this. And then Katie says, I also am skeptical about it. I feel like she might be lying.
You think she's throwing it?
Yeah. I think she's throwing it. But also, despite this, the real issue that you, the listener, should take, and you should point a finger at yourself for voting the famous cousin Katie MVP multiple times, but the real issue that you should take here is not that the famous cousin Katie didn't eat the cookies to be reviewed on the Peltoncast. It's that there were two giant boxes of cookies and the famous cousin Katie didn't eat any cookies.
It's truly a shocking development. I don't understand it, but
there was not a dietary reason. There was nothing. She just asleep at the wheel. Could not be me. MVP. Tristan Caracino. There are cookies.
How many of these cookies you have?
Oh, numerous. Numerous. I probably had more of the Bells because those were sitting around for longer, which maybe more on that later. But the Hello Robin cookies, more people could eat the Hello Robin cookies also. But the Hello Robin cookies went pretty fast, but I got in there.
you made an effort.
I had enough.
So, Bells and Hello Robin, two cookies that we, as we discussed in the group stage of our search for Seattle's best cookie, have at various times considered Seattle's number one cookie and looking to...
Various times?
Well, just I'm saying at some point is we've been passing the title belt. They are both have both been title belt holders.
Okay.
Hello Robin, you know, I think certainly for a longer period of time. But Bell's, when they came on the scene in 2020 during the pandemic at their original temporary location right near Seattle Pacific University, they've since moved to Green Lake. Like, we were going there weekly.
Yeah, no, we were pretty excited about
Bell's. We were going somewhere up north to pick up food and then making sure that we also got Bell's cookies. This was what Al Eats, where I was delivering it to.
Yes.
You would pick it up from my house and then you would take it back to the famous cousin Katie and her husband Ben, and all of us would enjoy Bell's cookies on a regular basis. So it came in real hot. You know, I think as I review these two cookies, one of the things that stood out, Bell's definitely has like the softness that I'm looking for, but I think the challenge is there's not that second texture, because if I compare them, you know, this is not specifically to Hello Robin, but I'm thinking about Treat, which is another one that came in real hot on the scene not long after that. Like, Treat, because of the way that the cookies are baked and their size, you generally have a degree of crispy or crunchy outside along with a very soft, gooey middle. And I don't think they're that same contrast in textures against the amongst the Bell cookies, which tend to be a little thinner. And one of the things we have really confirmed in this search is I like a thick cookie.
I don't know if Hello Robin are thick cookies.
No, they are. They're not as wide because they're smaller, but they are thick.
Okay. I feel like my favorite Hello Robin cookie is not that thick.
It's the salted butterscotch?
The salted butterscotch. I mean, to me, it's number one. Like...
I'm still going to call it this.
Oh, it's the Macclesmore guy forever. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but that's not your number one.
No, it's not my number. No. I'm saying the name is Macclesmore forever.
Gotcha.
The s'more. I don't know when they changed it. If they changed it the same time that the Mariners changed it,
They did.
They did.
Did not say that was the reason.
I have some questions about that as a decision, but. And the reason for that
the explanation was that they, at the same time, switched over. I believe it was Theo Chocolates before. I'm not sure who's providing the chocolate now, but that was the change at the time.
It's the only question mark that I have, for what it's worth, because I think everybody who's made that decision, I've made my feelings known on this, and my feelings are with Macklemore. But it's really, the Bell's cookies... They're good. They're not bad cookies, right? I mean, we're at the bracket phase.
Exactly.
And so everything that we're having is good. Like, there goes the famous cousin Katie right now, not even getting a cookie. And we got to bring her out here.
Oh, she...
Knock
she,
on the window and
she
wave
avoiding
Katie
you?
Over.
Okay.
This is good podcasting. Anyway, I'm just going to give a monologue about cookies right now. She needs to answer for her sins for not having had any cookies at all. We'll get her on the way back. The Bell's cookie is, I feel like it's an elevated homemade cookie. That's kind of what it is. And I think that might have been what you're talking about, not having like the next flavor. To me, the corn cookie is probably
my favorite.
I think
they have favorite. The flavor. I don't dispute the Bell's flavor.
The second
it's the texture.
And maybe the texture as well. It just doesn't, like trying them back to back, I'm like, Bell's is good, right? Bell's is a good cookie. Hello Robin to me is a legit contender for Seattle's best cookie.
Without question.
I
might so go so far as to deem them the favorite. That's a tougher call.
I had Treat recently, and I don't know. This is one of those things where like the taste test of if there's a box of cookies in my house late at night and can I resist eating them? I cannot. That it would be impossible for me to resist eating basic. They're the perfect size. They're the perfect size. They're the perfect price. It's the perfect cookie that I'm looking for. The flavors are interesting, but they're not. That's not necessarily the focus.
They're
really good cookies, and I feel like they're not trying to do too much.
I mean, you alluded to this earlier. The Carasino family, we voted with our feet on this one. And even though I got a dozen Hello Robin cookies and... seven Bell's cookies.
I was picking at the Bell's cookies for like into the next day.
The Hello Robin cookies went like that, which I understand why Katie might not have been able to get them. It's a little tougher to understand on the Bell's. So, yeah, I think this one ultimately was a pretty clear choice that Hello Robin is the winner and is going to advance on to the semifinals of our search for Seattle's, or the quarterfinals, I guess. No, we're already in the quarterfinals. Yeah, they're in the semifinals of our search for Seattle's best cookie and the finals of the cookie only region of the bracket. So,
you know, I think have semi successfully bullied Katie to come out here for one second. You don't have to deserved. Answer. We've already voted. Hello Robin won.
And no surprise.
Hello Robin just won. We just have one question for you, Katie. You have to come a little closer.
The microphone is not going to attack you.
There were two. This is I've already insulted the listener for voting you MVP multiple years in a row. I can say that as the current reigning MVP. Did you know that I'm the MVP?
No, I had no idea.
You didn't know that?
No.
Wow. You didn't make a plaque of it the way
maybe
the,
I should.
The famous cousin Katie did, which was real that. MVP behavior, I gotta say.
Katie's really mad about being here.
Giving it to us as a Christmas present.
Assaulting you and getting you to come out here is why I'm the MVP. My question for you is, there were two giant boxes of cookies in the house, and you say you had none of either of the boxes of the cookies, irrelevant of picking Seattle's best cookie. How did you avoid eating any of the cookies?
I don't know. I was just busy doing other stuff. I don't know.
Wow. Too busy for cookies.
I don't know.
You'd think that she had the 10 to 15 children.
I was kind of looking for the Bell's cookies because I remember liking them.
They sat there an entire day and you didn't see them?
I didn't see them. No, I didn't see them. I only saw the other one. Hello, Robin.
Right. A likely answer. Asleep at the wheel is your former MVP, the famous cousin Katie. Couldn't be me. I was there as the reigning MVP, current and reigning MVP, eating.
But let's describe it. It wasn't like there was two boxes sitting on the counter next to each other.
There were two boxes sitting on the counter next to each other.
There was one on the island.
They were next to each other on the island. Maybe you saw that the next day when the Hello Robin cookies had already been gone.
Oh, I only saw one box.
They went fast. So,
do you have any thoughts on the kickball game from earlier? Do you think that Al cheated?
Luca cheated.
Do you have any thoughts on Salad Bowl? We didn't talk about that.
Any thoughts on it? It's a really fun game.
Wow. Wow. Dynamite drop in.
No, we didn't talk about Salad Bowl at all.
What kind of background do you want to go into? First?
There were two nights of Salad Bowl. Many, many inside jokes.
Didn't we win both of them?
We technically tied the second one, but I'm pretty sure we won.
Salad Bowl's always a good time. Always a good time.
Well, there you have it.
Okay, you can go back to sleep. My favorite part was when you said it was like straight up like Charlie Murphy style. It's not like there are two boxes of cookies sitting next to each other on the counter.
There weren't.
If only we had taken a photograph of the two boxes next to each other. Sadly, I did not think to do that. So anyways, Hello Robin advances will take on the winner of the other side of the bracket. Is going to be Treat and Cookie Break in the cookies only section. That one's
forgotten. What is Cookie Break again?
Cookie Break is the place where you pick it up outside of someone's house. We got to make sure that they're still in operation.
Hello.
That one's going to require some planning, more than we had time for this time. And then obviously we have on the bakery side of the bracket. So I've set it up. I think we should put Ben's Bread and Saint Bread against each other right from the jump.
Have to do it. Because there can only be one bread.
Exactly. And that leaves then Volunteer Park Cafe and Pantry going up against Chicorina, which it's been way too long since we've had Chicorina. I'm very excited to go back there and try that again.
Was Volunteer Park the one that we had most recently?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
So this search is advancing apace. Don't know exactly when the end date is.
Yeah. Somebody we'll see you in 2026.
Somebody refuses to plan a live podcast, but at some point there will be a conclusion to the search because it is not abandoned. And with that, it is time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariner's hot takes coming at you.
It's kind of a sincere take.
Oh, no.
Well, this is it. After the trade deadline, the Mariners, now winners of three straight, 6 of 7 since the deadline, and just 2 games back of the Astros for the division, and 1.5 up on the Yankees for the second wild card, have the roster that is going to appear in the first World Series. No real take other than enjoy it. All the naysaying we're used to as Mariners fans is gone, because deep in our hearts, we know this team is special. And every great baseball season is capped by the guys who showed up late. Those midseason acquisitions we can talk about for generations to come. In 95, it was Andy Benes, Vince Coleman, and the Sheriff. In 2022, it was Carlos Santana. He was so smooth. And in 2001, I'm sure there was someone I don't know.
It really wasn't. Pat Borders was the closest
thing. Oh, God. But this year, we know the names. Yeah, it's Gino. But most importantly, the surprise ones. You naysayed it because you're wrong about everything. But Josh Naylor has had the biggest impact, and more is yet to come. But it's not just the gut feeling about this team. He drops. You're trying to disrupt the MVP's takes. FanGraphs backs it up too. With the Mariners now third likeliest in the AL to win the World Series. And the one thing I've learned at this part of the season is trust FanGraphs. They're much smarter than you and me. And most importantly, trust Mariners hot takes, because we are well on track for the Mariners to lead the division after the boys of summer have gone. So remember these moments. All of them. Every chance you get to see the Mariners right now is a chance to see the first series team in Seattle history. We're intrigued right now, maybe elevated even. But by September, it's going to be full-on pandemonium. Print out the front of the newspaper, silkscreen onto a t-shirt, and sold at North SeaTac Park level of excitement. So enjoy these moments and those ones. I remember back in 2005, Walt Jones was owning the line of scrimmage. Lofa was cleaning up every tackle. And all the dipshit Seahawks fans could say at the time was, same old Seahawks, but not me. I remember every moment. A Thanksgiving versus the Vikings, Monday Night Football demolition of the Texans, and said there is always something to break the rule. But if you want to bury your head in the sand, say same old Mariners, Katie, that's fine. But this team has real power hitters, not like 2001, a deep staff who can win in the playoffs, and a roster that is about to get its sixth ace and fourth outfielder back. And I, for one, am going to remember every moment of it.
I'm kind of disappointed. I thought you were going to do a no-holes take, because all of a sudden, the trendiest thing in Seattle sports is to say that the Mariners have no holes. Like, no, it's actually true.
I said you heard it here first on Mariners Hot Takes. I said who to trust.
You did say those things.
And now it's true. It was true then, and it's truer now.
I am not trusting you about when the Seahawks played the Vikings in 2005.
I didn't say the Vikings.
Would you say?
Monday Night Football demolition of the Texans.
What'd you say about Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving versus the Giants. It wasn't on Thanksgiving. It was when I was hosting things. Oh, it was like four days after.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was a classic. The overtime loss where the Giants kicker
Jay Feeling
missed multiple field goals. Yeah, I was at that Houston Texans Sunday night game. That was a fun one. Yeah.
Was it Sunday night, not Monday?
It was Sunday night.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember every second of it. It's fucking 20 years ago.
It was. It's fair. Yeah, the Mariners are just good now. It's like, obviously this could be a jinx. You never know what's going to happen. Long ways to go, etc. But the fact that Dan Wilson can just write out this lineup every night that is very good, the fact that, you know, the starters have been as good as they are. Bullpen, still some question marks there. The one spot that they didn't upgrade substantially at the deadline, Caleb Ferguson,
how
has helped a little
you.
Bit.
How dare you question Caleb Ferguson?
I'm not questioning Caleb Ferguson. It would be awesome if they could get Gregory Santos back.
Are people saying no holes?
Everyone's saying no holes, yes. Yeah. Get on the Discord.
I'm looking around. Is it just the Discord saying that?
No.
Is Seattle Times has taken this from me? Another thing? I invented no holes back before there were holes. Back when there were holes, I was saying that.
That's accurate. You like to say things before they're even true. That's how prescient you are.
Do you know who is fifth on the team in stolen bases?
The words no holes were uttered multiple times by multiple hosts on the Lookout Landing pod today.
Are you I'm standing up angry. I'm sorry. Credit where it's due. Did you see this thing on I have to send this to you. Jimmy Fallon. Do you know the song Days of the Week?
Maybe.
It's an Enumclaw song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, then yes, but it appeared on Jimmy Fallon?
You're aware of this?
No, I'm going from context.
Flight Facilities and Enumclaw Days Monday dancing. Tuesday, dancing. Wednesday, dancing. You don't know that song?
Vaguely.
The entire melody of it Jimmy Fallon did it as a take about a take, I guess, or like a segment about Donald Trump. No credit.
Wow.
It was a thing that Aramis wrote. That's right wild. There. And I am Aramis of No Holes right now.
That's a sentence that really doesn't make sense if you take it out of context.
It's just like the team didn't even, they've upgraded these positions. But I wasn't wrong when I said it before. And again, I'm more right saying it now. I'm so right that it's the kind of thing that you can't deliver these kind of takes. I wouldn't give a no-holes take. I've already given that take.
You know, the thing we didn't realize is how much the Mariners were bringing back chaos ball and improving their ability on the base paths with Josh.
I was going to say, do you know who's fifth on the team in stolen bases?
10 stolen bases in his first 12 games.
How is that possible?
Games. Mariners PR had this. It was the most by a player in their first 12 games with a new team since Billy Hamilton in 2013.
That is in Billy Hamilton?
Yeah.
First off, remembering some guys that Billy Hamilton played for the Mariners?
No.
Okay,
no,
this,
for any
on
team.
On a new team. Okay.
Yes. He was, I believe, making his major league debut at that point, right?
Josh Naylor, like, I saw him at first. And straight up with these stolen bases, it's like, I wasn't familiar with your game.
100%.
But also, I don't think Josh Naylor was familiar with this game. Because this hasn't been a thing that's happened in any
Mariners
other situation.
Knew. They knew. Like, give them credit. They, just like you were early on No Holes, they were early on...
Dan Sott.
On Josh Naylor is a stolen base threat, so...
The swiping second and third is truly incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun to watch, especially given the frame that he's bringing and the power that he's bringing out there, I should say. So,
but also, in those 12 games played, to have contributed, you know, war-wise more than Mitch Garver has, like, he's entering into Dylan Moore, Cole Young territory in just an extraordinarily short period of time.
Wow, Dylan Moore territory? So,
I mean, he's played all season. Dylan Moore's war was actually, like, not bad considering being a war role player.
He really was quite good in April. Yeah, that was his major league debut when Hamilton did this in September 2013. Currently playing for Charles de Jalisco of the Mexican
League.
Oh, there we go.
I was going to guess the Nippon Ham Fighters.
Always a good guess.
Not those Giants.
You mentioned this in the takes, some positive injury updates from GM Justin Hollander earlier this week to reporters.
Who only gets to report these? Jerry DePoto has to answer for all the hard questions, big news. Justin Hollander gets to give like a few injury updates.
He does other stuff as well. Bryce Miller is set to make at least one more rehab start at AAA Tacoma after he starts on Thursday, threw 52 pitches in his return to game action last week. Luke Rayleigh is set to begin a rehab assignment with Rainiers this weekend. And then Victor Robles.
We don't have room for you all.
We'll join Tacoma for rehab next Tuesday. Well, Robles, fortunately, will take the spot, presumably when they go up to 26 players. He probably won't be back until September, or 28, I guess they're already at 26.
Is that what you go up to, and you can't go up to the full 40 anymore?
No.
Really?
You had one position player and one hitter. Yeah, they changed that several years ago.
One pitcher and one hitter?
Yes, not one position player and one hitter. Those are the same.
Somebody just gets to play defense.
Would be an intriguing role.
I mean, Ben Williamson. He has a name. Who, I will say, have not been... I still like Ben Williamson, but have not been missing Ben Williamson right now with Gino back in the lineup. And
the vibes are good. Hard to say.
I mean,
hard to say anything else.
They basically haven't lost since this time period. And the contributions that they've gotten from Naylor has been a revelation. But that, with the way that Julio's been hitting, I'm just like... I can't imagine them not winning the AL West.
I'm sure you can. One other thing that Justin Hollander got to talk about in his update to media on Monday, or maybe this was Tuesday because they had Monday off. Top prospects and first-round picks Colt Emerson and Gerangelo Sanja were both promoted to AA Texas over the weekend. So, or Arkansas.
I was going
to
say, I thought the team was in Arkansas.
Yeah, I don't know how I read that wrong. Just saw the AS, I guess.
This guy didn't even realize we're in Benton County.
So excited to see them get to continue their development at a higher level of play in somewhere that really has been an important test for many of the Mariners' top prospects.
You know, when Sanja has like a 6 ERA. The only bad part about it is that I never made it to a game in Everett to see them.
It is the real disappointment.
And Arkansas is a lot further away than Everett.
Tougher road
Although...
trip. May also have a Benton County, though, I feel like.
I mean, so far, my ability to get to Everett has been... about as good as my ability to get to Arkansas. So,
should we do the roundup?
I, I just, for the Mariners, like, this is, it's just starting right now, but we are, like, nearing, I mean, it's always this trip that we've done it right around the trade deadline, and, you know, 2 years ago was, it was all dour, right? It was a negative. I think we were sort of talking ourselves into it. And then Ben, remember, he drove back. And then the Mariners went on like an incredible run.
A historic month of August.
Right after that.
Yeah.
Last year, they were in the mix. I think it was, if it was last year, I think, whereas like Fangraphs was pretty down on the team because it kind of saw, like, again, Fangraphs builds in the schedule in a way that human brains just don't, right? And knows it statistically. And I remember a couple of years ago where it was kind of like they were basically like 100% locked to make the playoffs because of teams playing other teams even further out before the Cal like clinching home run way before then. It was like it's only a matter of time. They're feeling quite good about this Mariners team right now, and not just making the playoffs would be great. You know, that is step one. But with how close the division is, and I was telling you because you hear everything on the Peltoncast first, I was telling you that You basically were like, do you remember this? Do you get tired of being wrong so often? But about how the Astros, they looked very hot, but I was like, when a team is that hot, they're just about to have a come down. They're just right away from that series that they get swept in, which happened over the weekend. And for the Mariners to be two back of the Astros with the schedule that they have, with the roster that they have, and the roster that the Astros have, to be frank, things are looking very good for them for the division. And they have not won a division, right? Since 2001. Is that correct?
Yes.
They were the wild card in, or they didn't make the playoffs, no, too.
They did not, famously.
The Mariners have won the division. I guess they won in 95.
Correct.
Did they win the division in 97?
Won it in 97. 2000 was a wild
three
card
times
appearance.
Ever.
And 2022 was a wild card appearance. I mean, you know, things are looking good for them. Fangraphs still has the Astros as the favorite in the AL West, to be clear.
By like a few percentage points.
It's like 48-42 or something like that. Maybe probably a little bit higher than those numbers. 50-43. The Rangers are still in the mix.
So I stand by my hot take from the beginning of summer, from way back, before there was Josh Naylor, before there was Eugenio Suarez, before there was Caleb Ferguson. By the time the boys of summer have gone, this team will be leading the division. That's not by the end of the year. That is by the time the children start school on August 27th.
August 27th, huh? I was at least going to give you until Labor Day.
I don't need it.
All right, anything else on the Mariners?
Nope.
Let's get into the roundup, starting with the Seattle Sounders. I guess we could have done this as a toast. Congrats to Sounders FC, the top seed from MLS in Leagues Cup. After the group stage, such as it is, I guess, whatever we're calling it. These aren't technically groups this time around. But the Sounders, the only MLS team, period, to win all three of their matches outright during Leagues Cup. Starting with a stunning outcome last Thursday. As we previewed this matchup, we failed to mention that Cruz Azul won the CONCACAF Champions Cup in June, beating Vancouver 5-0. In the final to tie Club America for most CONCACAF titles with 7. That's as many goals as the Sounders put in against the first half lineup for Cruz Azul, all of them after halftime. 6 different players scored, with Pedro de la Vega netting a pair of them, including Osaze de Rosario scoring again, and Nuhu finding the back of that. Scoreline obviously flattered the Sounders. They weren't 7 goals better than Cruz Azul, but they had 3.4 XG to Cruz Azul's 0.4 with 2 shots on goal in just one of the most impressive performances, I would say, in Sounders franchise history. On Sunday, they controlled the match with Santos Laguna scoring the opening goal in the 7th minute with an own goal set up by a Paul Rothrock cross. Sounders couldn't find a second for an extended period with a potential penalty overturned by VAR, but then Georgi Manungo doubled the lead in the 72nd shortly before he got set off for a second yellow. Santos Laguna did net a goal 6 minutes into stoppage time against the 10-man Sounders. They saw out the victory, and then they completed the perfect group stage on Wednesday at home versus Tijuana. Albert Rushnak missed a penalty just before halftime hitting the post, and Cholos followed with a goal against the run of play. just after that. But Asaze De Rosario equalized in the 56th, the third goal in the last four games. He can't stop scoring. And then Danny Musovski won it with a header off the corner in the 87th minute. Sounders will host the number four seed from Liga MX in the quarterfinals to be played either August 19th or August 20th. Could be either Tigres, Puebla, or Juarez, depending on the results of Juarez's match Thursday versus New York Red Bulls. Sounders back to the MLS regular season on Sunday, hosting the Galaxy. Galaxy come in last with in the West with 16 points from 24 matches and an ugly minus 20 goal differential. So this should be a good opportunity for the Sounders to get full points, despite the fact that, you know, they've been trying to advance in the League's Cup. Did still manage to get considerable squad rotation over these three games. So it really worked out perfectly for Brian Schmetzer and company in the League's Cup thus far. Seattle Reign FC returned from their summer break in impressive fashion on Friday with a 2-0 win over Angel City. Jess Fishlock, who came on at halftime, scored the opening goal in the 66th minute, then an own goal off of Fishlock's shot doubled the lead in the 86th. Fishlock subbed out and got a curtain call in stoppage time. Is her outstanding Seattle career that has dates back the entire Reign franchise's existence. Presumably starts to wind down at this point in her career. Reign had just two shots on goals compared to six for Angel City, with six saves from Claudia Dickey keeping the clean sheet. Newcomer Mia Fischel played the final 10 minutes plus stoppage time in an NWSL debut, while the Reign managed to win without Lynn Biondolo seeing any action off the bench. Up next this Sunday, a derby match against the Portland Thorns with playoff positioning at stake. The Reign coming fifth in the NWSL table with 24 points. Thorns 2 points back in sixth. Both have an identical plus six goal differential, but Portland has been very difficult to beat, where they are unbeaten with a 4-0-3 record. All right, Seattle Storm, as we record this, we are hours away from the WNBA trade deadline at noon Pacific time on Thursday. And so far, the biggest move has been made by your Seattle Storm,
who traded
Alicia Clark, Zaya Cook, and their
own... I thought the deadline had already passed.
No, not yet. Their own 2026 first-round pick to the Washington Mystics for Brittany Sykes, who is an all-star this year as an injury replacement for the first time in her career. One thing I didn't even realize until I looked it up today, after this trade was made on Tuesday, Storm now have four 2025 all-stars, more than any other team, which is pretty wild.
I mean, that's a big number. So this trade, obviously... an important trade, willing to part with one of their first-round draft picks. The least important, probably. Maybe the second.
Probably, although it's getting a little dicey with Las Vegas, which is pulled even with the Storm in the standings now, ahead of these two teams playing on Friday night. But you assume that by adding Brittany Sykes, you're going to improve your record the rest of the year,
yes,
and therefore weaken the draft pick. And even though Los Angeles is the WNBA's hottest team, including a win against the Storm that we'll talk about in a little bit, they've now won six of their last seven, snapped Indiana's five-game winning streak on Tuesday night. Like, it's looking increasingly likely also with Washington moving Brittany Sykes and kind of making a play for the lottery rather than the playoffs. Looking increasingly likely that the Sparks are going to make the playoffs and the Storm won't have any lottery picks this year. But still, you know, I think you'd say that that is the most valuable of these three picks because of its potential playoff upside. Vegas and Seattle, a little more debatable.
And the value of a non-lottery pick in the WNBA right now is still not particularly great.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this year's draft, there's certainly contributors to be found outside the lottery, but, you know, when you look at the players who are really changing the fortune of franchises, the three rookie all-stars this year with the two for the Mystics and Paige Beckers, and then Dominic Malunga, not an all-star, still the youngest player in the league, and a very exciting set of games recently. Anyways, that's the lottery, that plus those were the four non-playoff teams from last year, and that's where the real talent is in this year's draft. I mean, it's going to be more important, I think, to have depth, you know, in the draft going forward with more teams coming in, but you know, the picks in the 10s to 15s are more hit and miss in terms of what kind of value they provide for you long term.
Okay, but tell us about Brittany Sykes. How does she, right now, a team that's kind of needing some fortunes to be changed a little bit and needing maybe an injection of energy? Obviously, Malunga's been providing it and seeming like she's only getting better, but how does Brittany Sykes change the Storm for the rest of the season?
Yeah, she's someone, so I wrote, I guess this was last week, about, you know, potential trades. And I had the Storm going after Marina Mabry of the Connecticut Sun using basically a very similar set of players and picks to what they ended up trading to Washington. But also wrote in there that I thought that Sykes was the best fit for them or would be the top target for them, but just that I wasn't sure if the Mystics were going to make this her available because they were in the midst of the playoff race. And you know, obviously they decided to go that direction and you know, lean more into the rebuilding process rather than, you know, trying to their hardest to make the playoffs this year. So Sykes, number one, an outstanding defender. Before she missed half the season last year due to injury, had made the previous four all-defensive teams, two first teams in there. So you put her and Gabby Williams out there, the Storm are going to have two of the very best perimeter defenders in the WNBA. And then Skylar Diggins is a perfectly capable defender in her own right. That is going to be an outstanding perimeter trio. The Storm, already second in the league in defensive rating, got even better at that end with this trade. Offensively, the one thing that Sykes doesn't do that you'd obviously like to have for the Storm is shoot threes. She's, you know, below average three-point shooter. Has actually shot a better percentage than Alicia Clark has this season, because Clark just fell into a dreadful shooting slump in July and you know, lost playing time as a result of it. But she's a 30%, 31% career three-point shooter, 30% this season. That's not the strength of her game. But what she does do this year is get to the free throw line. Second in the league in free throw attempts per game. And this is a Storm team that is dead last in attempts and could really use that ability to get to the free throw line. So, you know, she's been playing point guard for Washington. She can, if she steps into Erica Wheeler's role in the starting lineup, which I don't think will happen at first, but I would bet on happening by the end of the season, sort of similar to when Tina Charles joined the Storm in 2022, and they kept the status quo for a while, but eventually moved Charles into the starting lineup. So she can also be someone who helps get Skylar Diggins off the ball, helps bring up the ball and initiate the offense the same way that Erica Wheeler has as a starter.
So the both of them can kind of go back and forth as far as like ball dominant guards.
And with Gabby Williams in the mix too. Like there's just, you know, I referred to us in the story, I think it's going to be the most versatile backcourt in the WNBA, all three of these players being all-stars this year.
And a pretty versatile frontcourt for the Storm as well.
I mean, yes. And look, that gets us to the point where they should be playing better than they are. Right now, they have lost three. They went 0-3 on this homestand. All heartbreaking losses. They had Skylar in double overtime against the Sparks on Friday. Skylar Diggins had a floater in the lane that would have tied it in the closing seconds. On Sunday against Indiana, they had five threes in the final minute, seven that would have tied it that they missed. Many of them good looks.
And that's a Caitlin Clarkless Indiana team.
Yes, but that entire winning streak has come without her. And then Tuesday against Minnesota, a team playing without Nafisa Collier, so a good opportunity for the Storm to get the win.
I didn't realize they were without Nafisa Collier.
Yeah, tight game all the way, couldn't score a lot of the fourth quarter, and then made a bunch of threes late to get back in it, but never got the ball down with three with a chance to tie. So three losses on this homestand by a combined 10 points. And look, WNBA playoff positioning, there's not a huge gap between the Sparks right now in 10th and the New York Liberty in 2nd. And the Storm now have dropped to 6th in the league, tied with Vegas for 6th. So every game counts the rest of the way, starting as soon as playing Vegas on Friday, when Brittany Sykes will probably make her Storm debut.
What is the expectation now? Because they're inching toward 500. Looking at the standings after that Lynx loss, it was closer to 500 than I thought it was. And some of the cushion that they had from early in the season has been, I mean, the last month has been pretty dreadful as far as standings go, right?
Yeah, since the All-Star break. I mean, even going back to the Connecticut loss, the high point of the season undoubtedly was when they won at New York on, that would have been July 6th, I believe.
Okay, so what is your expectation, your reasonable expectation for this team going forward? Where do they finish?
So this is where it would be nice to have a WNBA fan graphs that I trusted to the same degree to show you, you know, kind of what was going to play out with the schedule. But
I wonder who could make such a thing.
Some of us are busy and like have not been as good at rating teams in season.
I'm sorry for being so busy.
Like, part of what's happened here is the Storm have kind of come back to where they were in point differential. They were outperforming their point differential. Now they're probably underperforming their point differential, but because they're tied in the standings with Vegas. And Vegas, in part because they lost by 53 to the Minnesota Lynx last Saturday with Nafisa Collier in the lineup, has a negative point differential in the season.
God.
And the Storm are still comfortably positive.
I mean, the 53-point loss is going to hurt things.
So, like, you look at it from that standpoint, and Vegas has played a lot of the season without Asia Wilson, or a bit of the season without Asia Wilson, so you have to kind of factor that in. But, like, the Storm should be ahead of Vegas. They should maybe be ahead of Phoenix, who is ahead of them in the standings. But I think the top four now have kind of separated themselves, and it may now become a challenge for the Storm to catch Atlanta and Indiana. But I say that, and you know, there's still a game back of Indiana and only 2.5 back of Atlanta.
Yeah, you don't see this as a situation sort of, right? Like the Mariners lost that game, lost 2 of 3 to the A's, and they lost that game, traded for Geno that night, and they're just like, fuck this, who cares? You know, like, it didn't matter what happened in that game the moment they traded for Geno.
The MLB season is a lot longer than the WNBA season.
But...
And this is not quite as perfect an upgrade as getting Geno back.
It seems like a pretty important upgrade. And
I mean,
it's
probably
going to
be the biggest
deal
made in, you know, we'll see if anything happens Thursday morning, but it will probably be the biggest deal before the trade deadline.
Biggest deals made at both deadlines.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it as basically this team has hovered right around this place where they've lost to some bad teams, and they haven't quite been good enough to beat a couple of the very good teams, but have been very close. Like that Lynx loss wasn't a terrible loss. Is a Brittany Sykes the difference?
I think in a game, if you're losing by 2 or 3 points, I think she can provide that upgrade, because part of it is like this, the reason that this might be better for the Storm than for the Mariners is like Penn Williamson was playing a credible third base all season. The Storm guard play has not been nearly good enough. And one of the unfortunate things about this is, like, I was super excited when Alicia Clark came back to the Storm, a full circle moment where she started her career. Now that she's the oldest player in the WNBA. And it didn't work. She didn't
How old
play
is Brittany Sykes?
She's around 30, 31, somewhere in that range, maybe 32.
What is the contract situation, or just everybody's up, so it doesn't
everybody's
matter?
Everybody's an unrestricted free agent, yes. It didn't work out. So I was at Storm practice last Thursday, and afterwards, Noel Quinn had an extended conversation with Alicia Clark that certainly looked pretty intense. On Friday night, Alicia Clark was out of the rotation. It was her first DNP CD since her rookie season with the Storm. And then Sunday did get a chance to play, didn't play a lot, missed both shots he took. And I think at this stage that the role wasn't what Alicia Clark expected, and that this was not a move that was received unhappily for her.
It just wasn't working.
So, and, you know, they brought in Tiffany Mitchell, and she's given them some better minutes, but still, you know, this is a team that had really 6 reliable players, the 5 starters and Dominique Malunga, and adding a 7th to that group is a pretty dramatic difference. Because one of the things that happened in that double OT game against LA, the Sparks also, you know, particularly with Cameron Brink still on a minutes restriction, although she has made an immediate difference defensively, because it was just her second game this season, 2 of the thinnest teams in the league. Neither team made a substitution in either of the overtimes, and the Storm were just gassed by the end of it. I mean, the LA actually played heavier minutes in that game than Seattle did, to your argument. But, you know, getting someone else who can just be part of the mix is going to be, I think, a huge benefit from that standpoint. And the other element that's going on, as we sort of mentioned earlier, is Dominique Malunga is getting it in real time. Finished the game on Sunday against Indiana ahead of Ezzie Magbegor. Continues to just be a difference-making force at both ends of the court. With
I mean,
size.
I think it was 6 for 8 last night.
Yeah.
Against the Lynx.
Started 5 for 5.
I mean, still probably deserves more minutes.
I mean, it's tough.
Right,
Ezzie Magbegor is very good, has been an all-star in this league, was a key player for the team that won EuroLeague 5 months ago, whatever it was. And you are starting to wonder if there's a point where Malunga needs to start over her because she's the future of the team. I mean, I don't think we're going to get to that point this season, but certainly in terms of finishing games, we've already gotten there.
I mean, I'm happy that Noel Quinn has recognized that much at the very least. I think it's taken a little bit too long to get to where we're at right now. But
Dom is also just playing better.
These are a lot of positive trends. And I think the Storm are probably going to finish the season pretty strong.
And we should talk about the reason, like, okay, so all of these positive trends, why is the team losing all these games? One of the big factors is early on,
they hadn't traded for Brittany Sykes yet either.
Granted. Early on, they were leading the league in 3-point percentage. And it was kind of like a, we'll see on that one, given the level of shooting on this roster. And now they have slipped to, you know, the middle of the pack. They're 9th in 3-point makes, they're 9th in 3-point attempts. If you're near the bottom of the league in 3-pointers and near the bottom of the league in free throws, you just don't create a lot of easy points.
Yeah.
And that's been a huge problem for them. And like I said, that's where Sykes, with her ability to get to the free throw line, even if she's not a great three-point shooter, will help. And like Erica Wheeler, as awesome as she has been, as important as she has not been quite the same player the last month that she was leading up to. It was a month ago, that high point, that July 6th game I mentioned. And, you know, I think that was to be expected. They signed her for the minimum. She didn't have a great season last year in Indiana. There was, you know, a little bit of regression to the mean that was going to be baked in there. And Gabby Williams shooting, we've also seen that come back to earth a little bit, even though she's still terrific overall. So, you know, even though Neko Gwumike is playing the best basketball of her season right now and Malunga is coming on, that's sort of what's caused the storm and what you hope Brittany Sykes can help address.
All right. Well, I guess we'll find out on Friday night.
A pivotal one. A pivotal one. After that, then the Storm play another important game against LA on Sunday. As we've talked about, these games kind of double for the Storm because not only are they trying to improve their playoff positioning, they're trying to keep the Sparks, desperately to keep the Sparks out of the playoffs. So beating them head-to-head in the two remaining matchups is really important. And also, frankly, like at this point, they got to be a little worried that the Sparks might catch them in the standings in their own right. Like, I don't know if that's a likely scenario, but they are now only two games back at this point. So... a lot to watch. All right, UW football. I don't really have a lot to report from fall practice.
Denzel Boston's coming back. Denzel Boston had a bit of an injury.
Yeah, he was limited in spring practice, not on the field to start fall practice. But, you know, and would love to see him get that those reps with Damon Williams, but... You know, some younger receivers have taken the opportunity. Desmond Roebuck, in particular, as a freshman, has gotten a lot of attention for his performance in camp thus far. But still a long ways to go here. I guess not that long to go. We're a little over 3 weeks away from...
It's just college football is one of those situations that if there isn't a catastrophic injury, you're just not going to hear that much until the season starts.
You sort of see, I mean, we'll see what Jed Fish is willing to say in terms of the depth chart at certain positions and how that's taking shape. But you sort of find out a lot in week one.
Yeah.
In college football. Seahawks, Charles Cross underwent surgery Thursday to repair a dislocated finger that he had practiced through after it popped out again. Expected back prior to the start of the regular season. Would prefer to have him out there, certainly, but also good to just kind of get this taken care of and not have it nag through the season.
Not worried about it at all.
And here we go. As we record this, we are less than 24 hours away from the Seahawks playing their preseason opener and welcoming Pete Carroll and Geno Smith, who might play, back to Lumen Field for the first time as visitors.
Kind of a hilarious game to start with.
You have opted not to attend this game.
I'm so anti-preseason games.
You've made your opinion well known.
But we're driving back. I probably wouldn't even get back in time to go to it. So,
really?
I don't know. I might.
Some of us are competing hard enough to go to Lady Gaga Climate Pledge
well,
tomorrow.
Good for you. Couldn't be me. This is my flu game. I'm not interested, to be honest. Like, I'll maybe turn it on, but I am so fully in the headspace of I don't believe any of these stories matter, and I don't believe any of the stories matter until they matter in preseason football. Like, I'm not going to get that excited about any. Torrey Horton is somebody who...
I was going to say, yeah.
There are certain players, like, I'm curious to see Milroe, right? I'm fascinated to see what he looks like. I'm curious to see if Torrey Horton makes any plays. Obviously, the Seahawks seem very excited about him. It's going to take regular season football for any of this to actually matter, and nothing in preseason at this point can look like regular season football. So, to me, if they get through it, if they avoid injury, that's all I really care about. If there's a breakout performance... I'm not going to care that much. So if there's anything that I'm watching for, it is kind of just, it's curiosity more than it is anything else. I think there maybe could be a performance that Jalen Milroe has that says something, but like, is there a world that he goes into week one starting? Absolutely not.
It seems pretty unlikely. The first task is to breed out Drew Glock.
And honestly, at practice, watching them, obviously the running is such a huge factor with Milroe. Drew Lock and Sam Darnold are much better passers than Jalen Milroe is right now. They're much more accurate passers. They're much more comfortable. They've done these drills more times. Like they are more comfortable in an NFL training camp throwing passes than Jalen Milroe is.
As they should be.
It is a different element that he's going to bring. whether, even if he could do that in a preseason game, I'm not sure if that's going to matter. And if he's good enough in a preseason game, I think it'll kind of just make the regular season more annoying.
That's probably true.
There's almost nothing that can happen with Jalen Milroe that it's not going to be annoying, other than Sam Darnold is so good that there's no question about who the quarterback is. Save for that, it is going to be annoying, and maybe it'll be exciting at various times, but like, we saw what it looked like last year with Sam Howell.
That is true.
So I don't know. I just kind of like, if Nick Emmanuel makes plays, that would be awesome. I'm excited to see Nick Emmanuel. If he's making plays in a preseason game, that's cool, but I'm not going to care that much. Maybe this is a bad perspective, but I don't think
it's a bad perspective.
They play three games. They're not going to play almost anybody by the third game. And then there's a couple of weeks off, and then we get real football. But until then, it's an exercise in going through the motions.
We've gone way through too long through the podcast. That just triggered a thought. PeltonCast Fantasy Football. If you want to play this year, PeltonCast@gmail.com. Send us a note. So
that's if you're new.
If you're returning, we'll shoot everyone a note within those leagues to check if you want to be back. So, but that is coming up sooner rather than later. So we should get going on that one. And if you made it this far through the podcast, you are a real listener.
You probably want to play.
Either that, or you were trying to skip forward to the after the pod section and you missed.
That's not very good.
But no, I don't think that's the wrong perspective. One of the things I like, there is
not caring is always the right perspective.
Hashtag PeltonCast nihilism.
with regards to, I mean, sports, kind of. I don't know.
Chuck Klosterman had a discussion about how bizarre it is that we decide that some games don't matter and other games do matter.
He's wrong about that, though. Really, see, I take offense to this, because the games matter different levels of importance. Just being like, these games don't matter. Like, they play different players and they play a different style of the sport. So,
but his point is that there are not actual like real life consequences to the games in the regular season or even in the playoffs.
I mean, sure, fair enough. I just don't want to say saying that nothing matters is right, because there are things to care about in the world that do matter. But
that's very accurate.
So,
primary elections were Tuesday, so that was interesting to see those results. Speaking of things we should care about. Anyways, what I was going to say
is... I didn't see what the results were.
Well, you're going to enjoy them. I said that as if I didn't. Which was not my actual response.
You're going to enjoy them.
You're
going
to enjoy them. yeah. There is probably some added predictive value for players, young players and players trying to make the roster of these preseason games, because there is a degree of greater reality putting on the pads and the helmets and going against another team that doesn't necessarily know your scheme the way that your own team does. But the thing to remember is there are 5 weeks of practices in three preseason games. There is so much more data that the coaches are getting in the front office is getting in practice than they're getting in the preseason. And just because we're not there, other than you last Thursday, we're treating those as functionally irrelevant and like, only paying attention to the three games because those happen to be publicly televised.
The things that we see even in those practices, you know, like there's just so much more to it.
Yes. So, take all of preseason, I agree, with a grain of salt.
I liked it better when they were just in Cheney, and it was like they were off in space.
Well, we would actually be closer to them now if they were in Cheney.
There we go.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Easy. But
that's because you're scared to talk about the results of the kickball game earlier, where your team lost.
It's so funny podcasting with you in person, though. I feel like I'm on the Talk to a Podcast or something with us sitting here on couches. It's like episode of the really good podcast. None of our listeners understand these references. It's okay.
I mean, the problem is we're not being filmed right now in most podcasts that are done in person.
I agree.
Exclusively for the video.
Yeah, no, we circled all the way back around and invented television. we invented like morning talk shows.
You know, those were those are quite popular for a long period of time. But imagine if you could watch them whenever you wanted.
Nobody is wanting to watch these things.
Some people must be.
Watching podcasts? No, it's just there's money to spend. You know how this goes. It was like ESPN built that studio and they were like, sorry. Some networks have built studios that were very expensive when money was good. And then sometimes money isn't as good and you scale things back.
If you're going to make a more apt comparison, it's to the pivot to video period where that was favored over written content, I think, would probably be the more apt comparison to this pivot. But the difference is no one's getting rid of the audio podcast. It's just that I have to make sure my hair looks good before I go on a podcast.
Did you, when you went on this week, did you have to, was it video too?
Yeah, of course.
Oh my God. It's like criminal to make people do that. Also, people are worse at talking when they're being filmed.
I mean, you're being filmed either way. I'm not like...
Am I being filmed right now?
Okay. When I'm recording a podcast via Zoom, I'm getting filmed either way. It's just whether they're posting it or not. It's the only issue
is
having to fix my hair and worry about what I'm wearing. So if you do...
Was your hair that fixed? I guess I should watch now.
I mean, it wasn't
watch a podcast, of course, because I'm not a psycho.
It was considerably more fixed than it was before, earlier in the day.
It feels like it's like something that's trying to attract an audience that just won't listen to it. And you're like, we have to get young people listening to podcasts, podcasts.
Some people do just listen to them on, many people do listen to them on YouTube. The listener, Third Pelton brother Noah Cohen, does listen to this very podcast
right
on
now?
YouTube.
Right now,
no video. Just a
logo. I'm okay with the idea of clips being pulled from podcasts for socials, but the idea of watching a full podcast is psycho behavior.
Look, everyone is free to do whatever they want to do and consume
media. That's not true. Media. Not everyone is free to do whatever they want to do.
Okay. People are free to consume media whichever way is most favorable or convenient for them. You dispute this take?
I mean, it's still a little bit too open.
No, it's not hurting anyone.
Okay, I've successfully pivoted away from the results of the kickball game.
You really did. Yeah, your team lost, and I had an inside the park home run. That's the important things to know here, the takeaways.
Inside the park. You literally had a great moment that you could have just described. You hit a grand slam.
I guess that is true.
And you called it an inside the park home run? It's like the worst branding that I could have. It's like Peltoncast level of branding.
It's a fair point. I was not thinking, I did not spend enough time thinking about the grand slam part of it because I was more concerned with the successfully getting all the way around the bases. Now, one issue was one of your sons, I had to make sure he was going fast enough ahead of me that I could complete the base pass.
One of my many children. I should have been in center field.
One of your 10 to 15
Leaving Katie
children.
In center field was a mistake. If I'd have been out there, it would have been maybe a stand-up double.
Tough to say.
But also, I mean, we were playing on a 300-foot baseball
field.
Yes,
it is very funny from that context that I described it inside the park. Kickball is not really noted.
The greatest kickball moment of all time. If you would have kicked that ball at 350 feet.
It would be the Happy Gilmore origin story of kickball. Someone would see me and be like, you should be an NFL kicker.
Are we going to talk Happy Gilmore, by the way?
It's not on the rundown. It's not in the notes.
Okay. I feel like we have to discuss it from the Seattle perspective.
Okay.
How is Kelsey Plum in this movie?
It was a very random cameo, especially because there were no other WNBA players, were there? Were there any other like non-golf professional athletes?
Non-golf professional athletes? I'm going to say...
yes, because Travis Kelsey was prominent in the movie.
There were enough cameos that I'm like, there had to be some.
But the cameos were primarily golf in nature.
It was pretty strange. I mean, I literally didn't even think it was Kelsey Plum because I was like, no way that could be Kelsey Plum.
It was pretty recognizably Kelsey Plum, so I did not have that thought. I just kept waiting for there to be other people in that same ilk, and there wasn't. I mean, Travis Kelsey is like legitimately part of the plot line, so it's a little different.
Kind of, yeah. What were your thoughts? You really liked Happy Gilmore, too.
I really liked Happy Gilmore 2 is strong. It delivered exactly what I was looking for in Happy Gilmore 2. I wasn't going there expecting Citizen Kane. Going there to Netflix. To the home screen on Netflix. Expecting Citizen Kane. I wanted some nostalgia from my youth that would not tarnish the memory of the original movie. And Happy Gilmore 2 succeeded on every level in that from that standpoint.
I think it's like... I heard K-pop Demon Hunters be described as monoculture. this week, which I think is probably an apt take. And I have to say, Netflix is really winning the summer. This was the one, I didn't have any after the pod talk, but there was a Pitchfork thing on like...
I'd like to note that the Bear, you know, Andor is in the summer, but that as well.
I'm talking about like things that are actually popular in like a larger scale. And K-pop Demon Hunters, I don't have the viewership numbers from Netflix, but we're probably talking hundreds and hundreds of hours more than The Bear. Is The Bear out, the new season?
Yeah.
I literally didn't even know it was out. So if you're talking about monoculture, this is a show that I ostensibly pay attention to, and I was unaware. I kept being like, when is this season 3 going to happen? 4?
This is season 4, yes.
And I feel like it has not had any social impact whatsoever.
Critically well reviewed.
Is it really?
I'm still not through it, actually, but we'll get there.
I honestly don't even know if I'll watch. But the K-pop Demon Hunters and Happy Gilmore 2 in a scenario that I think I would say has cross-generation. And I think that's the impressive thing about Happy Gilmore 2. I don't know if I can stand up for it as a work of art or even a work of comedy. However, I do know that children like it and elder millennial parents also like it, and probably even slightly older than us.
That's the sweet spot right there. That's what you're looking for.
So it's an impressive feat is what I will say. Like, and it's one of those things, it's almost like the Rewatchables podcast, like they have some movies, like, yeah, some are rewatchable. This is going to be rewatched probably more than any movie that comes out this entire year.
Your children have put it on multiple times.
It's just, that's what it is. It's like in the background, just Netflix is up, Happy Gilmore 2 is on. Like, it feels...
The children literally created a Netflix sub-account called Gilmore.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So I will give it that. It is a very impressive feat from that perspective. And having these two things... So another complaint that I have is, like, Pitchfork had a thing today about... Which, again, this is no... I'm not standing behind the platform.
You know, before we turned on the microphones, Tristan said he did not have much to talk about.
I just thought about it. I had one thing. They were like 20 contenders for a song in the summer. And I'm like, 20 contenders for song in the summer? First off, a song of the summer doesn't have contenders.
Exactly.
The song of the summer doesn't like sneak up on you. It presents itself. What the song of the summer is.
It forces its way into your life.
The other take that I have is there's not always a song in the summer.
Absolutely. And so, I don't think there has been this year.
No, I totally agree. There's not like, and last summer was so dominated by multiple songs and albums, and it was really like artists of the summer that I think people feel like it has to happen year over year. I've talked about this before, but like there are a lot of artists whose brains were broken by Sabrina Carpenter, Charlie XCX, and Chappell Roan. You know, like that moment happening, I think the pop stars that are slightly sub those have had a really hard year. That is what a song of the summer should be. Not, oh, it might be this, or people like on the list.
If you have 20 candidates for song of the summer, you have zero contenders for song of the summer.
Exactly. And people might have made a list of 20 last year, but it was like
they were doing that just for the clicks.
Yes.
I mean, I think there was two.
There was also Not Like Us last summer, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, Espresso and Not Like Us were the songs of the summer. And
To me, it's Hot to Go, the entire Brat record.
I think Brat could have been the album of the summer, but I don't think it had the song of the summer, because I don't think there was any one song that stood out the way that Espresso is ubiquitous, and particularly like, because to me, part of the criteria for song of the summer is it has to be something that you constantly are hearing at, in my case, WNBA games.
See, I think Hot to Go was
in
the one.
NBA that, Summer League games.
Hot to Go more than any of those, if it was one. But that's the thing, is they're also, when you have a song in the summer, people get too locked into the terminology of it, to the singular nature of it. There can be multiple songs of a summer. That doesn't have to be one. And it can be dominated by a few things, but it has to be dominated by that.
It has to be, you have to hear it constantly without actually trying to hear it.
Absolutely.
So.
But this, like, the closest that we have to that is not necessarily, the K-pop Demon Hunter songs are like the most popular songs on all of Spotify. So there's probably,
I don't think I've heard any of them.
Just wait.
Okay.
You will. It's we're still in the early phases of it, but it's like it is a I don't want to use the word tsunami, but like there is
we'll still real, a little too soon.
Real momentum behind it in a way that the trend is probably not going to die. And it's because of the combination of the two TV shows. I mean, not the combination, but like those two TV shows. Netflix has definitely owned the summer if there's one piece of culture.
Congrats to Netflix on being the song of the summer.
I mean, it's kind of true.
So, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Shouts to the 509.
He said he wasn't.
Shout out Benton County. Is this Benton County?
No, we're on Franklin County.
Shout out Franklin County. Wait, are we sure?
Yes.
Well.